This time on your weekly Constitutional, an interview with James Madison.
Now, having been in open rebellion since His Majesty King George III proclaimed it in August of this previous year, having been embroiled in the various measures of warfare since those shots were fired at Lexington and Concord, America, from the taverns of New England to the tobacco fields of Virginia, has debated what it would be. Over the course of that, we see the Second Continental Congress convening, the sword of Damocles hanging over its head. Various states put forth resolutions, all bound with a question which will echo through time immemorial. What shall be America's stance on independency?
That was Brian Austin, a James Madison interpreter from Colonial Williamsburg. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week we're going back in time.
Welcome to your weekly Constitutional, underwritten by the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier. Your host is Professor Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at the Duncan School of Law of Lincoln Memorial University.
Have you ever wanted to go back in time and speak to some prominent historical figure? I certainly have, and as you might guess, James Madison is at the top of my list. When I'm out at Montpelier, I often feel very close to old Jemmy, and that was particularly true this past June of 2019, when I was out there for a conference and to my great amazement and joy, found that they had constructed something new. They call it their constitutional time machine. It was right there on the table in the Potter family studios.
Well, my machine seems to be working. All the dials are lighting up, all the power is humming, but the one dial that won't spin is the one that selects the month. I'm stuck in the month of June. Well, perhaps some important things happened in June. Let me check my copy of Ralph Ketchum's biography. Yeah, June. Oh, well, we're in luck. Lots of important things happened in the month of June for James Madison, and in fact, one of them is one that you might not be aware of at all. Let's turn the dial back to June of 1776. Let's press the button and... Welcome. Welcome, Mr. Madison.
Thank you, Mr. Harris. I'm exceedingly pleased on this occasion to keep correspondence with you, but I'm... Well, sir, I must say in candor, I am somewhat perplexed that you've chosen this small, confined closet in which we might correspond.
Well, there have been some technical changes recently. We'll talk about those later. But if it's all right with you, Mr. Madison, could you tell me what's happening in this month of June 1776?
I should be excessively pleased to. Now, having been in open rebellion since His Majesty King George III proclaimed it in August of this previous year, having been embroiled in the various measures of warfare since those shots were fired at Lexington and Concord, America, from the taverns of New England to the tobacco fields of Virginia, has debated what it would be. And over the course of that, we see the Second Continental Congress convening, the sword of Damocles hanging over its head. Various states put forth resolutions, all bound with a question which will echo through time immemorial. What shall be America's stance on independency? Now, North Carolina has issued forth a resolution that if independency were to be introduced, they would vote in favor of it in Congress. Rhode Island, ever a tenacious province, has voted for independency solely for itself. Now, upon that, the eyes of Congress look towards Virginia. Upon the head of the Continental Army sits a Virginian. Virginia sits the largest, the wealthiest, and if you will ask a Virginian, the best of these various provinces. And so, for the deliberating of these past several months, a convention has sat within the capital of Williamsburg, bound with that question of Virginia's independency. This convention, the Fifth Virginia Convention, the Virginia Revolutionary Convention, is situated in that former House of Burgesses, whereby the gentlemen of this greatest age, an assembly of titans marked with all forms of civility, but deadly, nevertheless, have been debating upon Virginia's stance for independency.
Mr. Madison, if I may interject, first of all, you've told me something that I did not know. Rhode Island separately declared its independence?
Mr. Harris, should it really surprise you that Rhode Island should do that?
Well, I know that you often refer to it, and many of your generation, as Rogue Island, so in some sense I'm not... Let's just simply say I had overlooked that, so that's a very interesting historical tidbit, and I'm trying to imagine the independent nation of Rhode Island and how well it might have done.
Well, Mr. Harris, we likely have the whole population of Rhode Island situated within this closet, so they say democracy ought to be small. I suspect Rhode Island should thrive.
I suspect you're correct. You also said, Mr. Madison, that this was the Fifth Revolutionary Convention.
Could you update us a little bit on the first four?
I should be excessively pleased to. Now, in 1774, Parliament changed the face of proceedings forever betwixt America and its mother country. Now, after there were over nearly 10 years of oppressive taxation, various constitutional measures, the people of Massachusetts, ever prone to greater boldness than they have reason, destroyed several hundred pounds of tea by dumping it into Boston Harbor. Now, for that, Parliament passed a series of acts. The closure of Boston Harbor through the Boston Port Bill, the quartering of soldiers within homes, but most of all, the removal of Massachusetts civil government, setting the precedent that in the name of safety and order, they can remove our right to govern ourselves. Now, from the course of that, we understand the English Constitution is precedent. So the House of Burgesses in Williamsburg gave great pause to this. In 1774, they called for a day of fasting, reconciliation, and prayer. Now, Mr. Harris, this seems somewhat innocuous, yes?
Mm-hmm.
Yet it is important to remember the last time a legislature utilized this prerogative, a prerogative typically belonging to the king and executive, was in the time of Oliver Cromwell. And we know those various series of events worked for Charles I.
Not a very happy outcome.
No, indeed. And so for that, they were dissolved by our last royal governor of Virginia, John Murray, the 4th Earl of Dunmore. Now, upon that instance, these gentlemen, elected by the various freeholders of Virginia, had a great decision fixed before them. They could return to their various vine and fig trees, they could bow to British authority, or, since they could not be permitted to meet as Englishmen, perhaps they could meet as Americans. Now, the dilemma was, Mr. Harris, they could not meet within that capital. They needed a place large enough to accommodate them. They needed a place close enough to the depository of public records. They needed a place discreet enough. And so, there upon the brink of revolution, they do what likely any man in desperate circumstances would do. They went to a tavern, specifically the Raleigh Tavern, run by a Colonel Southall of Charles City County, I believe. And 88 of those gentlemen formed the first Virginia Convention. Two things were accomplished there within that convention, holding august members like George Wythe, Thomas Jefferson, and Patrick Henry. The first was a Virginian association, a binding agreement as to what goods would or would not be imported. And the second, far more prolific, was the general call for a Continental Assembly, a grand meeting of a large scale at a place central. Not only these 13 colonies, but provinces of Bermuda, Nova Scotia, all received invitations to this august assembly. And yet, ultimately, it would be these 13 provinces. And so, in that vein, the very idea of multiple provinces coming together as one, the very idea of a federated body of men coming together to compromise came from that Apollo room of the Raleigh Tavern. And so from that, various conventions followed. The Second Virginia Convention convening in Richmond, Virginia, where Patrick Henry, a gentleman I'm certain you have heard of or have heard, issued forth those famous words of give me liberty or give me death. Now, the Third and Fourth Convention were bent much more upon martial affairs. Committees of safety were formed after Lord Dunmore fled and began waging his piratical war upon the people of Virginia. And Virginia was reduced to various committees to run the auxiliary counties. From 1775 up until this Fifth Virginia Convention, I have served upon the Orange County Committee of Safety with my father, my uncle, along with prestigious gentlemen like Thomas Barber. Now, the Fifth Virginia Convention was bound with a unique purpose, the likes of which had not been seen, to answer, of course, the question for independence. And the convention, convening, needed to do several things first. First, to acknowledge its authority, replacing the House of Burgesses as Virginia's governing body. Next, electing its presiding officer, Edmund Pendleton, a cousin of mine. Everyone in Virginia is a connection of someone. But from there, the true deliberation began. Now, I will be candid with you, Mr. Harris. I arrived in proper Virginia fashion to this assembly late. The journey from Orange County through the wild and woody territory of the Piedmont was affected by the rainy seasons. And so I arrived 2 weeks late to that assembly, but did arrive in time happily for that august vote for independence upon the 15th day of May, 1776. Now, the resolution was specific, sir. It was bound thusly that Virginia would instruct its delegates in Congress to introduce the topic of independence, and as one united continent, we would vote. And this was for a specific purpose. Various resolutions previously debated several things. There was one resolution put forth that first we need find a foreign ally. This was inevitably thought ill-humored, only because we did not expect going to a sovereign to ask assistance for rebelling against our sovereign would be terribly conducive to progress and happy alliance. One gentleman, a gentleman by the name of Meriwether Smith, as I understand it, put forth a resolution that from Virginia, we vote for independence for all these provinces. And we thought that negative in the realms of parliamentary order and how it ought to be done. And so the final resolution was that it would be introduced by Virginia and voted as a continent there in Philadelphia. Now, this would be historic enough. This would be respectable enough. If that was all that was bound within that resolution. And yet the last clause of this aforesaid document bears the true history and the strike that constitutes the epoch which has been rendered in this year. The last clause of that aforesaid resolution was that there be crafted a Virginia Declaration of Rights, and whatever form of government was most conducive to our liberty, our happiness, and safety.
Well, I commend the wisdom of thinking beyond revolution. Revolution is an important event. Independence is an important thing. But once you're independent, what happens next? How will you then govern yourself? And so I understand several colonies were in the process at this point, weren't they, of drafting their state constitutions.
Indeed, indeed. In Williamsburg, have given little credence to what various governments are moving within the other provinces and countries to the north and south of us. But upon that, immediately after the resolution for independence, a committee was formed to craft a Declaration of Rights, to craft a constitution. As Hutchinson says in his great work, Oceanus, any government that seeks a great reformation on the minds and manners of mankind is imaginary.
You have to take human nature into account, don't you?
Specifically, sir, specifically. I suspect if men were angels, no government would be necessary. Do you have a pen and paper, sir? I think I ought to write that down.
I think you should. Yes, absolutely.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Now, from the course of that, there was one gentleman desperately needed over the course of the deliberations as we began to determine what rights would be enumerated. You see, we sit in the most unique facets of history, whereby we began a government not with the powers and charters thus aforementioned, but instead with the notion of liberty, setting a precedent that it is not a government that bestows liberty, but that liberty is in itself innate and natural, and the responsibility and end of government is to secure that liberty. A paramount precedent set in this singular moment. Now, from the course of that, acknowledging that in media vitae and morte sumus, in the middle of life, we are in death, we know full well that the various liberties that needed be enumerated need be not only specific, but derived from that natural order. Now, a gentleman arrived shortly after the resolution for independence, a gentleman of Fairfax County by the name of Colonel George Mason. While not bestowed with any great sociability, when he finds himself awakened, is not only one of the most able men in debate, but the most apt men in the various political precepts that constitute the notion of the social contract. And so the beginning of our Declaration of Rights began thusly with just that, a statement of social contract theory that has been bestowed from John Locke, thus distilled from Justinian, even more so down to the notions of Aristotle, utilizing the various intellectual resurrections bestowed upon us in this enlightened age to craft a statement of natural liberty. I will flatter myself, sir, at 25 years of age, never hoping for any great degree of politics, I am myself bestowed a particular amendment to that Declaration of Rights that, well, I will say is significant to my own conscience, that, of course, pertaining to religion. Are you a Virginian by nature, Mr. Harris?
Oh, certainly by nature.
Then you will be familiar with the hell-conceived idea of intolerance, which permeates specifically through these western counties, having but one sole sponsored church, the Church of England, functioning as an imperio, an imperium, a state within a state. We have seen that pervading bite of prejudice, prejudice of those dissenting Protestant faiths. Don't get me started upon the Catholics, sir. But rather than being greeted as fellow members of the same family, instead they faced the bite of a whip, the cold of a jail cell, to such volume that many of the county jails scattered through Virginia are referred to as Baptist prayer houses.
Mm.
Now, is this liberty? Is this harmony? A tyranny exists not solely in the forms of oppressive governments, but equally the tyranny of our fellow man, various factions, parishioners of different demagogues who view this difference of opinion as a constitute for a different spirit in that way. As Paine wrote, those who distinguish civil intolerance from theological intolerance are mistaken. Man will not live with those he regards as damned. Now, this was justified for so many years because of the act of toleration. Now, religious tolerance, meaning a government may tolerate your religion so long as you follow the various articles of the church doctrine. Now, what we have introduced in this year of 1776 is the 16th article of that Declaration of Rights, saying that religion, or the duty which we owe to our Creator, the manner of discharging it can be conducted only by reason and conviction, not by force or violence. Therefore, all men should enjoy the free exercise of religion according to the dictates of conscience, and that it's the mutual duty of all to practice Christian forbearance, love, and charity towards each other. This seems a small delineation of verbiage, a small delineation of words, and yet it is this specific piece, this specific crack in those various chains that will, in my estimation, allow Virginians' minds to one day be free. Citing this as a right should inevitably allow in our policy to greater extend the liberties of those who have been disenfranchised, disallowed, persecuted for so many different years.
Are you more concerned with the persecution of the church or with protecting the state from too much religious influence?
We have seen in every instance through the history of the world the various instances, the various ecclesiastical establishments, rather than forwarding an agenda of mercy, charity, and morality, instead a contrary methods. We have seen the ground soaked in the blood of ecclesiastical war, ecclesiastical conspiracy. We've seen these various factions enlisting armies of partisans by which to sway a people. Let us examine Virginia. There are those who would take this mere distinction of color, you use it to justify the most oppressive measurement of man over man, and there are those who will utilize ecclesiastical establishment and scripture to justify it upon those grounds. And it is more, sir, that in my opinion, Christianity has survived not only without the assistance of government, but in spite of all opposition from government. And so in that regard, in my own estimation, it is a way by which our government may remain untampered with, while simultaneously our faith may remain simply that, faith. Sanction belongs in government, not in regards to the duty man might owe to his Creator.
I understand, sir. Could you also comment about the Constitution of Virginia itself?
I should be excessively pleased to. Any day now, we shall find ourselves upon the third and final vote for the final Constitution of Virginia. It contains a preamble within it that speaks of the specific injuries done by His Majesty King George III. I know not if independence will carry in Philadelphia, but I have no doubt whatever a declaration or document citing our independence will likely have these similar justifications of the injuries His Majesty has placed upon us. But secondly, then enumerated are the various powers by which this government will have. We sit in a fortunate age, Mr. Harris, an age mankind has never before been afforded to, whereby we can utilize these various works of mankind examining not only government but human nature, and from that derive a government from it. And so we have utilized Montesquieu's spirit of the laws, his notion of separating the powers of government, enumerating the three purposes of government, to legislate, to execute, to adjudicate, and from that building a government around it. We have crafted a bicameral legislature in the form of a House of Delegates and Senate, both elected by the people. We have crafted a chief magistrate, having a great fear of executive power. That magistrate will operate with a council of eight and will be elected by joint ballot of both House and Senate. And last therein is a court system
when
for
Virginia.
When
you say magistrate, you mean a governor?
I speak, of course, of a governor for Virginia.
All right.
Yes.
Okay.
And from that, it seems fairly obvious, sir, that the first governor of Virginia will likely be none other than Patrick Henry. Now, this may seem an honorary, sir, and yet I have heard simultaneous some gentlemen speak in secret that it is a measure to get him out of the legislature.
Promote him out of a job. Understood. So you expect that to pass?
What will be next for Virginia then, after you have a constitution and your Declaration of Rights firmly in place?
Well, from there, we shall step away from the art of crafting constitutions and reduce ourselves to the Stygian depths of committee. The 5th Virginia Convention will have various appropriations by which to conduct committees of election, privilege various conduct measures for the war. But from that, we will likely dissolve this representative convention, step away from the Tidewater heat with a plan in motion to reconvene in the fall, whereby, for the first time, this Constitution will be tested to the various rigors, whereby statutes shall be revised to justify these various ends, whereby, through our policy, we can take these notions of life, liberty, the means of acquiring and possessing property, the means, and indeed, measure of pursuing happiness, and from that see if, with our policy, we can craft a government that is equal to our aspiration.
Well, Mr. James Madison, a freshman representative to the 5th Virginia Revolutionary Convention, it sounds like you have a very busy June, so we will bid you goodbye and good luck.
I'm your humble servant, Mr. Harris.
It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week we're on a time travel journey. We've just gone back to June of 1776 to speak to the young James Madison, who was helping to draft the Virginia Constitution. After the break, we'll come back and go to a different June of 1788. Stick around. It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and now it's time to continue our discussion with Brian Austin, an interpreter at Colonial Williamsburg, who portrays James Madison. Well, now it's time to fiddle with my constitutional time machine again. It's still stuck on the month of June, but I seem to recall that June of 1788 was just as important in its own way as June of 1776. So I'll hit the dial and I'll press the button. And welcome back, Mr. Madison.
Mr. Harris, it is a privilege to see you, sir, and I confess that despite that it has been 12 years since last we found ourselves acquainted, I should say you have hardly aged a day.
Just healthy living, Mr. Madison, healthy living.
Remind me, sir, to take up some correspondence with your physician. I should use it after the various turmoil and business that I have been thus embroiled in over the course of this past year.
Oh, tell me about it.
At this present stage, America has faced itself with another epoch, a second revolution, this not bound by that same sanguinary quality of bloodshed that was our late war with Great Britain. This one, instead, a great desire to avert those various appeals to the sword that so many revolutions have seen. Mr. Harris, I take no great satisfaction in unfolding to you the various circumstances that have fixed America since our victory against Great Britain. Since that time, being in the infancy of constitutions and confederations, being in a wilderness without a single footstep to guide us, we have witnessed America's confederation moving down the sullied road towards anarchy. The Articles of Confederation, ratified in March of 1781, have proved a deficient system of government. Being void of any sanction, any degree of coercion, we have witnessed the pervading bite of jealousy betwixt the states. We have seen the violation of treaties, acts of open rebellion like that of Mr. Shays, and in sum, the forwarding of 13 separate spirits of government, which inevitably move every day towards colliding or instead drifting apart. And so, having been in Congress from 1780 to 1783, having sat a member of the Virginia House of Delegates, through the course of this decade, it has been my prerogative to find some solution by which we can allow a system, a free system, a republican experiment of government to endure, not only for ourselves, but equally through posterity. And when we last spoke, Mr. Harris, we had the opportunity to choose for ourselves whatever system of government was most conducive to our liberty, our happiness, efficacy, and safety. And for that, we chose the most volatile, detrimental, and turbulent system of government imaginable. A republican form of government, not only one, but one that utilizes that electric power of democracy. A democracy which, through the annals of time, if we examine it, fails. And from that, through the course of that, we began to realize that our experiment to prove history wrong was indeed failing, joining the stack of various other misguided confederations. And from the course of that, I was not willing to consign myself to the opinions of the majority, that what was necessary was greater power, even, yea, down the road towards despotism. And so, happily, I sat with an advantage. Beginning several years ago, my dear friend, Mr. Thomas Jefferson, after the tragic loss of his wife, took up a position at my advice as Minister Plenipotentiary to France. Now, from that, I knew full well that the solutions for America, and indeed the solutions of what lay ahead, could easily be found by that which was behind, the various previous free experiments of government, not only of the medieval world, but of the classical world, the Greeks, the great republics, the cantons. And so from that, Mr. Jefferson and I struck up an agreement. Having some 1,000 books already within my father's possession in his library, I knew full well that I could use a few more. And so from that, Mr. Jefferson and I came to arrangement. I requested, in response to caring for his nephews, if he might send me several volumes of books pertaining to confederations ancient and modern that might be particularly interesting in the measures of good government. Well, sitting at my seat at Montpelier, where we are now, I can recall the day that the wagon arrived and the crate of books came. I was very satisfied. I was somewhat perplexed when the following week came and another crate of books arrived. I was entirely flabbergasted when the following week came and three more crates of books arrived. Very quickly, my father's library became an old-growth forest whereby I could navigate those various columns of books like a doe in the wood. It was a fine hiding place for my oppressive younger brothers and sisters.
Were you actually able to read them all?
Excessively. I adopted a regimen, sir, whereby I would awake. I sleep some 4 hours a night. And from the course of that, after breakfast, would confine myself within that library, reading until the light proved so poor and too poor by which I could easily continue, in which I would spend several spare hours entertaining with my family, playing at cards, or thinking upon that which I had read today. And over the course of this, reading the confederations of Amphictyon, Achaean, the Lacedaemonian leagues, the Helvetic and medieval Swiss cantons, as well as the various state governments, reading the encyclopedias of Diderot, reading Fortunato Felici's Code La Humanity, I pored through these various thousands of volumes of books to endeavor to find how a confederate system of government might thrive. And through the course of that, I recognize, sir, that perfection need not be pursued in government. There is no proper way by which we can conduct ourselves, where a system can last. Instead, I began to wonder if perfection could not be pursued, at the very least, a more perfect system might be crafted. And from that derived a plan of government which was introduced in Philadelphia City in 1787, referred to as the Virginia Plan, introduced upon the floor of the convention by Edmund Randolph. Now, you see, Mr. Harris, there was some confusion when we arrived in that convention for the business of May in 1787. The gentlemen assembled from the 12 provinces, Rhode Island did not send delegates, thought in every instance that they were rendering the Constitution of the United States, the Articles of Confederation, adequate. This was the mandate given by Congress. I had already decided it would be far easier to render the old qualities in a new system then take new qualities and place it in an old system, because we find ourselves bound with a dangerous precedent. A system of government that grows in power over time has been proved in history to be far more tyrannical and dangerous than enumerating the powers at the start and then guarding over them. And so I knew full well that what was necessary was a lex scripta supreme law, one that was not secundum subjectum materium, one fixed with enough energy by which to regulate the government, yet simultaneously derivative and limited in its powers, like Copernicus's solar system, a supreme body governing some 7 state and planets, yet limited so as to render those various planets governance of their own various properties.
But how does one limit the power, the sovereignty of the state?
In every instance, my sanguine hope, something which did not find itself in the Constitution, was a federal negative upon state laws. This negative did not find its way into the Constitution, and I will confess to you its absence was one that grieved me a great deal.
So you actually were proposing that the national government could veto or could nullify state laws.
In some proper form and fashion, yes, some measure by which it can check the various state agencies that either move against a spirit of liberty or violate a treaty betwixt these various other states. What we were seeing consistently and still see are these various states continuing to grow in rivalry, whereby we find these various distinctions of factions, North state and South, large state and small, continuously working against one another. I wish to find some mechanism, be it in Congress or in the revisionary council of an executive and judiciary, to find some measure whereby state laws can be reviewed by a federal government.
So you're more concerned about the rivalry between the states than you are about excessive power in the central government.
I see no greater danger to America than the various abuse of state powers. I could not foresee any instance, any day whereby we might be debating power in a federal system of government. I see no way in which that could catch on. I must wonder, Mr. Harris, if you detect the sarcasm in my voice. I've never had a great sense of humor.
I do indeed, and I can read it in your face as well. How is ratification going at this point in June of 1788?
In any instance, I will say with great happiness that we will see here in this enlightened age the hope of a second revolution without blood. Virginia, as of the 21st day of June, 1788, has ratified that document by a slim majority. I will confess.
Wait a minute. Aren't you considered the primary author of this document? Isn't George Washington from the Commonwealth? How could you encounter such resistance here in your home state?
Well, first, I will say you flatter me. Government is not like the fabled goddess of wisdom, the work of one mind. It takes many heads, many hands. And I will confess, sir, your opinion and your sentiment was very close to my own. After the Constitutional Convention, I returned to New York, where Congress was meeting, only to find that Congress did not have a quorum and could not meet. There was no sanction under the Articles of Confederation mandating congressmen to attend, and so they did not, left to their various other interests. And so, fixed with so much time on my hands, and knowing that New York had a less favorable opinion than the Constitution than my own native Virginia, it became the scheme of one Alexander Hamilton. Have you heard of him? His name
is
Alexander Hamilton.
Yes, I have.
Now, from the course of that, he proposed a series of essays written anonymously, going to several people, Governor Morris, the author of the preamble of our Constitution, Mr. John Jay, myself, Mr. Jay, and Mr. Hamilton, all agreeing to undertake the business. Mr. Hamilton began the enterprise adopting the nom de plume Publius, Publius, that great hero of Republican Rome. And from the course of that, through 1787 and 1788, Mr. Jay wrote some 10, Mr. Hamilton 51, and I wrote some 29, my 29 far superior, all bound for the singular purpose of ensuring that New York ratify the Constitution. Now, all the while, I suspected that Virginia, knowing full well the players of that business having the sanction and approval of the Constitution, His Excellency, General Washington, myself, for whatever it might be worth, and yet there were those in Virginia who did not trust the business. A gentleman who of late within the legislature I have found myself disagreeing with upon many things. A gentleman who, with a mere clearing of his throat, can cancel any argument I spend 30 minutes building. A gentleman who, out of honor I will not name, but if Patrick Henry were here, I'm confident upon those grounds he would unfold his own various decisions and vices as to this system of government. Now, Henry was nominated to attend the Constitutional Convention, but said he smelled a rat. And Mr. Henry was perfectly pleased with the Constitution and very quickly became a champion of what was called an anti-federalist camp. For Mr. Henry, his country was Virginia. He feared, in every instance, the notions of a republican form of government extending. And in truth, in some regards, a philosophy would say he was right. It was Montesquieu who said republics ought to be small, they ought to be homogeneous. But in my research, through the various studies, I realized that there is far greater security in an extension of a sphere of government. Of the multiplication of these various factions serving as a check to one another, that we see greater security in a popular system of government by ensuring the extension of those various powers and ideas. And so, learning that Mr. Henry would be at the debate for ratification, I knew full well I needed to be in attendance. And yet I will say, Mr. Harris, I was in very poor health. Arriving at that convention, I found in many instances my voice too weak to carry across the room because, if you can fathom it, Mr. Harris, we convened within a theater.
Oh, my.
Yes, 130 gentlemen assembled for that ratification convention were too large a quorum to meet within the State House proper. So we moved to an academy built by a Frenchman and assembled in a theater. Now, from that, Henry utilized every measure of pathos that he could to convince those not to adopt the Constitution, appealing to man's prejudice, appealing to man's interest. My dear friend, Mr. Governor Morris, visiting the debates, wrote an extemporaneous poem speaking how Mr. Henry endeavored to debate upon slavery, the Mississippi River, and indeed any topic he could that was not the Constitution to ensure the Constitution did not pass. Now, upon that, I debated Mr. Henry to the best of my aptitude, despite my illness, and I flatter myself that not just myself, but the various other gentlemen in favor of the Constitution allowed for it to pass. While Virginia's vote was necessary, it was not the final state needed for ratification. We learned that in the midst of our debates, another state, the ninth state, had ratified. Now, from that, there are various things ahead of us, Mr. Harris. A promise, an oath, was sworn as insurance that this Constitution could pass. You see, a great many gentlemen opposed the Constitution not for what was in it, but rather what was missing. I speak, of course, of a federal Bill of Rights. Now, for myself, I am not in favor of one. It was brought up at that convention in Philadelphia as to whether we should have a Bill of Rights in it. In September of 1787, towards the end of the convention, George Mason, you may remember, the writer of the Virginia Declaration of Rights, said that he would rather chop off his right arm than adopt a constitution without a Bill of Rights.
Perhaps you should have called his bluff.
Well, he further insisted that we could do it in an afternoon. And Mr. Harris, if you've been around men of government, you will know that men of government cannot sign their names in an afternoon. And moreover, I had a great apprehension for several reasons. First, in my opinion, an enumeration that is not complete is not safe. Should we enumerate select liberty? Shall we be a people of 10 liberties, 12 liberties, 16 liberties enumerated in time, or a people of the infinite rights of human nature that might be decided by posterity? Now, secondly, a federal Bill of Rights insinuates the notion that they are given by a government rather than protected by a government. Any enumeration on that led me to some concern. And last of all, it was my feeling that these declarations of rights were simply parchment barriers. Let us examine the Virginia Declaration of Rights. Let us examine the enumeration of the free exercise of religion, and let us see how, with our policy over the course of these past 12 years, we have still seen oppression. Because, inevitably, if man wishes to do ill, they will do ill. Let us take, Mr. Harris, the Ten Commandments. The Ten Commandments came from God, yes?
I suppose so.
God and his will is perfect, yes?
I suppose
and
so.
Man is imperfect, yes?
Very
and
much so.
So has this perfect declaration issued from a perfect being stopped an imperfect man from killing? Has it stopped him from stealing? Has it stopped him from coveting that which is not theirs? And so from that, we see the sanction of law outside of these declarations, the boldest intentions by which we can ensure those liberties. And yet, still, there are gentlemen in Virginia who will not accept a constitution without a Bill of Rights. And so after several conversations with Baptists, of whom their regard I hold very dear, I agreed that should this constitution be ratified, I should take into consideration the various suggestions and, within the first legislative session, begin the work to craft a series of amendments to ensure the constitution has a Bill of Rights, whereby it can be enumerated in the body. And I do suspect, sir, that it should be within the body of the document. I cannot foresee in any instance tacking the amendments on to the bottom of the document.
Oh, understood. Again, it sounds as if you have a very busy June, indeed, a very busy few years ahead of you. So I will once again thank you and bid you farewell and best of luck.
Good day to you, Mr. Harris.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and we've been on a time travel trip today. We went to June of 1776 and then June of 1788, two very important months in James Madison's life, and we spoke with Madison interpreter Brian Austin. After the break, Brian will speak to us out of character and talk about portraying Madison. Stick around. It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris. Well, now it is time to finish our discussion, but not with James Madison this time, with his alter ego, a marvelous young man by the name of Brian Austin. Brian, thank you so much for being here today. I have so enjoyed our discussion.
Well, thank you, Stuart. I appreciate that. I'm grateful that we could make this happen and come out and play a little bit.
How did you get to this point of being such a superlative Madison interpreter for Colonial Williamsburg?
I thank you for the compliment. It's very, very gracious. I think sometimes playing Madison is the ultimate imposter syndrome. I consistently, oftentimes, feel like I get the height test. You know, I'm 5'9". Madison's, you know, famously short, 5'4", about 120 pounds.
Wait a second. You're telling me you would actually wish to lose about 6 inches in height?
You know, I always hated how short I was until I started playing Madison, and then I started hating how tall I was. I've been portraying James Madison and studying James Madison for about 7 years. I came to Colonial Williamsburg completely by chance, completely by accident. And while I was there, Madison was picked for me. Now, I don't know who decided that I should play him. I don't know what that conversation looked like. But it set me down this very unique road, which has been one of the most fruitful and beneficial things to ever happen to me.
You're obviously an accomplished actor, but your knowledge of Madison is extraordinary. How did you come by all of this?
Reading, really, you know, about a month into studying Madison, because, you know, it started in a very Mickey Mouse way. You know, I'm James Madison, take my picture, don't ask me anything hard, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. I had the benefit of playing him at 25 before he'd done anything and only having to go until 17 and 81. So the big things, the complex things, that could wait until later. And if I could shout, you know, rah, rah, liberty and everything, then people would like that, and that would be fine. But I guess I was doing that too well, because about a month in, they sat and said, you know, President's Day weekend is coming up. That's in February. We'd like you to join our George Washington and our Thomas Jefferson on stage as President Madison. Now, again, I was 25 years old. It terrified me. And so for about 2 months, I was confined to doing research. I was confined.
You were like Madison up in his second floor
precisely,
library.
Precisely. Uh-huh. And, you know, suddenly, for the first time, I heard this, you know, little man speaking to me. I suddenly found a commonality. You know, I found who he was as a young man at 25, wanting to grow old in a free country. And I found a symbiosis in that. And I began to find my voice as Madison. That was 7 years ago. You know, I play Madison in Williamsburg. I'm there every day. I'm now too old to do that, technically. I'm still going to do it. But right now, you know, my eyes are on Madison in Congress. My eyes are on 5 years from now, where I have done something really important with my life, where I'm going to feel entirely underaccomplished. I think what's really awesome about that, what's really great about that, is you begin to temper yourself into the role. The words come easier. The Rolodex of quotes come more naturally. And the moments where your sentiments end and Madison's begin become a bit more seamless. And so for me, it started, of course, with Ketchum. Mm-hmm. Ketchum's biography was the first thing I had in hand.
Ralph Ketchum, yeah.
To start with Madison's
He's been
work
on the show, and that was a great interview. I'm so glad I got him before he passed away.
Yeah, and, you know, from there, moved to other biographers, you know, on both sides of the aisle. You know, Madison's unique because you find people of different political parties write not their version of them, but they write their interpretation of his life. Mm-hmm. And so he gets factionalized in a unique way. But from there, I very quickly realized that it would be a completely un-Madisonian thing to take what other people said about Madison and attribute and move towards that direction. You know, Madison's motto late in life was veritas non verba magistri, truth, not the words of teachers. And so I had to go to the source. And so it was Madison's writings. And not only Madison's writings, but Madison's readings. Montpelier is such an amazing institution because you can go online and see what Madison had in his library. Mm-hmm. And so you can pick up the histories of Herodotus or Puffendorf or Thucydides or Tacitus or Thomas Aquinas or Newton, and you can pull through them. And so the work is not only reading Madison and reading what Madison read, but also reading what Madison said about what Madison read. You know, you can read Jean-Jacques Rousseau's Social Compact, but you need to know what Madison says about Rousseau and universal peace and his sentiments of what Rousseau has to say. You have to understand to interpret Madison's interpretations of his readings. And that's hard. And, you know, it becomes a wonderful avenue in which you can play detective. You know, I have to be really careful sometimes when I'm reading through the notes of speeches Madison gives in Congress, because I know how good of a politician and debater Madison is. And I know full well there are certain instances where he's speaking in Congress that he's not necessarily manipulating, but he is catering to people's interests to navigate them down the path he wants towards compromise.
Yeah, that's manipulating.
Yeah. You know, and his mind only continues to boggle and baffle me. And, you know, that's been the hardest thing for me. You know, I never considered myself an overly intelligent person. I was not a good academic student. I used to say often that there was a particular history professor that I had in college, and what I wouldn't give to be in a room with her so she can see, well, you know, what I'm doing now. And then a couple of years ago, that happened.
Did it really?
Oh, yeah. And suddenly I felt like a little kid.
How did it happen?
I was doing a dinner at Fort Monroe, and she was there. Fort Monroe's in Hampton, Virginia, the
right.
Casemate Museum. She was there, and I said, I don't know if you remember me, but you had me once in one of your classes, and I didn't do well. And she very, very graciously said, well, if I had you now, I'd give you an A, which was nice.
That's very nice indeed.
And
hey, you mentioned that we were at Montpelier, and we are at Montpelier. We're here for a conference, a really good conference, preparing to, well, actually in the process of commemorating 1619, 400 years ago, because of several important things that happened in Virginia at that time, one of which, of course, was the slavery, the introduction of slavery, another one, the first encouragement of women to come here, the celebration of the first Thanksgiving. And then the fourth event was?
The first General Assembly of Virginia.
The House of Burgesses.
Yeah. And, you know, Stuart, this is something I've been waiting to say, and I just wanted to sort of find a time to bring this up. There is a gentleman from England who's coming to portray Governor Yardley, and he said something fascinating the last time I spoke to him. It is regarded that this is the longest standing English-speaking
yes.
assembly in North America. But he remarked about the English Civil War, and he regarded it as the longest consistently running General Assembly, English-speaking General Assembly in the world.
Because of the interruption.
Because of the interruption.
That is a very interesting observation, and I'm sure that all of our Virginia friends will be extremely, extremely happy to hear it. You actually suggested the organization of today's show based upon the month of June, because we are in the month of June 2019 as we sit here. And from your encyclopedic knowledge of Madison, you immediately recalled several extremely important events. And that's how we've organized ourselves today. So the first one we talked about was 1776
mm-hmm.
and the drafting of the Virginia Declaration of Rights and the Virginia Constitution. Then we fast forwarded 12 years to 1788 and talked about ratification of our national constitution. What year are we in now, or what year are we concerned with now?
Yeah, so we sit on a kind of remarkable day, and especially a remarkable day to be on the grounds of Montpelier. It's a very somber day to be on the grounds of Montpelier, because we find ourselves on the anniversary of Madison's death.
Yes, a date of which I'm so sorry to say I was ignorant. Now, I knew he was born on March 16th.
Mm-hmm.
They commemorate that every year. But June 28th,
mm-hmm.
of what year?
1836. Madison spent the last few years of his life in very bad physical health, but never in mental. He moves to Dolly's former parlor with a door adjacent to the dining room so he could still participate in conversations. But he suffered greatly from arthritis and various other health ailments. And he had been declining in health gradually. Dolly was out of the house. And from that, the physicians had been asking him if he wanted to take stimulants, if he wanted to take stimulants so he could die on the 4th of July, like Monroe, like Jefferson, like
right.
Adams.
That would have been with the 60th anniversary, wouldn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And, oh, my goodness, yes.
And Madison, who has no great love for mysticism and austerity, said, no way.
No way.
But we do, and this is an incredible thing, we have a wonderful legacy left by Paul Jennings, who I think is easily one of the most underrated American heroes.
Mm-hmm.
Jennings was Madison's personal manservant. He shaved him every day, read to him likely from the newspapers when Madison couldn't hold them. And we have his primary words of what happened when Madison died, and I have them right here. He said, "I was always with Mr. Madison till he died, and shaved him every other day for 16 years. For 6 months before his death, he was unable to walk and spent most of his time reclined on a couch, but his mind was bright. And with his numerous visitors, he talked with as much animation and strength of voice as ever I heard him in his best days. I was present when he died. That morning, Sookie brought him his breakfast, as usual. He could not swallow. His niece, Mrs. Willis, said, 'What's the matter, Uncle James?' 'Nothing more than a change of mind, my dear.' His head instantly dropped, and he ceased breathing as quietly as the snuff of a candle goes out." Now, I find this a particularly beautiful thing, only because for Madison, conscience was the one issue he never deviated from. The mind, in his mind, was the greatest property someone could possess. And to go that bravely into death as another bold adventure, an escalation, another level of thought, to me, well, I'll say it comforts me.
What sort of legacy, other than the Constitution itself, did Madison leave us?
A great question. He showed that government is not about a single accomplishment, but of a ricochet of accomplishments. He shows the power of what happens when you're willing to pass the baton, when you're willing to sit and say, "I want this accomplishment to happen, and I don't want it to be just my work that sees it there." Madison didn't build one pedestal that he could stand on. He built a forest of pedestals that he hoped the people could rise to. And it's through that that Madison's example becomes a quiet reminder of the power not only of humility, of compromise, but also of the mind and of thought. He asks something to be brought and distributed once he passes. He says, "Let it be considered as," and I'm going to paraphrase this a little bit, "let it be considered as coming from the tomb." He says, "The advice nearest to my heart and deepest in my convictions is that the union of the states be cherished and perpetuated, that the open enemy be regarded as the Pandora with its box opened, and the secret one as the serpent creeping with his deadly wills into paradise." You also see in Madison's later years great advice to people regarding systems of education. They often consult him as to how women should be educated, asking if women should study geology or other subjects as men. And Madison every time says, of course they should. He says, "The capacity for the female mind of studies of the highest order cannot be questioned." And you
proto-feminist.
You find simultaneously various addresses to live amongst the symmetry of nature, to not make nature subordinate to your wishes.
And a tree hugger too.
And a tree hugger too.
Oh my!
And more than that, you have countless papers and volumes on the spirit of government, the function of government, and how a system of government can endure. Madison, I like to think, was a political anthropologist. Because he didn't study the time he lived. He studied mankind, how they can change, and how they can change by their consent and not by a government dictating what they should be.
Well, with those ringing words, Brian Austin of Colonial Williamsburg, also known as James Madison, and a darn fine one, thank you for being with us today.
It's good to see you, Stuart.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to Brian Austin of Colonial Williamsburg. And, of course, thank you, as always, to James Madison, without whom this program would not be possible. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. Our music is by Hannibal's Elephant. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, you are a part of the American experiment.